today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
30 years ago, an album came out that was so big, it was gigantic.
Oh, yeah, you mean Faith by George Michael.
No, I'm talking about the Pixies' Surfer Rosa.
Oh, yeah, where is my mind?
Okay, Patrick.
Yes, Jim.
What were you doing in 1988?
1988, let's see. I had just completed, probably dropping
parole?
Out of... Yeah, no, it came in 89.
Okay.
I had just completed dropping out of several different universities. So I think I was on my third or fourth one at that point. So things were looking good.
Just trying out some different...
Just trying out different, you know, yeah. Majors and philosophies and different things like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Very good.
Living on friends' couches. Things like that, scraping change.
I was in college at the time.
Yeah.
And I remember living with some roommates who were really into, you know, alternative rock,
yes.
College rock, uh-huh. And so on. And I remember at one point, one of them getting this album that mm-hmm. you brought over here
yeah.
today, Surfer Rosa by the Pixies.
By the Pixies.
And I remember it being on the stereo and just how cool we all thought it was.
Yeah.
That it just had a really distinct sound, I think, for the time. So we're going to get into that here in just a second. This is Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
And I am Patrick Foster.
And this week we're doing some album anniversary shows.
Yes,
right?
We are.
Because mm-hmm. we like to do these usually closer to the anniversaries themselves,
right.
But this has been a crazy hectic year. And
yeah,
so we're
really
kind of playing catch up. And earlier this week, we did a couple of anniversaries that really should have been done in January.
Yeah.
And this one, Surfer Rosa, came out in... Well, it depends on how you look at it.
That's
true. We might be behind, we might be ahead. But
yeah.
it came out in the UK in March of 1988.
March of 88 on 4AD Records.
It apparently did not make its way to the US until August of 88.
That's correct.
So maybe we're actually ahead on this. I don't know.
Yeah. So this
is 30 years ago.
Yeah. This is the rough trade version I have that came out in the US in later the summer of 88. But yeah, you're right. The first one did come out over there in March on 4AD, which talked a little bit about that label last week.
Which is a weird thing. I always think of, like, this is an American band
yeah.
from Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And yet their album was released on an English label. Mm-hmm. And the only way for a while you could get it in the US was via import. You know, remember
you know,
when you would go to the
true.
Store and they'd have
yeah.
like a little import
That's
section
right.
and they were like really expensive?
Yeah.
Because there was no... The way that worked was they didn't have a U.S. distributor, but
that's right.
but somehow there was some way that it would actually formally get imported over from the U.K., but
mm-hmm.
really limited way, right? And
there
certain
were
specialty
yeah.
shops would have them
right.
and things like that, right?
Yeah, and I remember there was a company just from working in record stores called Gem that was like an importer of records that would bring a lot of them over. Dutch East India got into that business before it turned into Hopestead. There's some importers that would do that kind of thing. Yeah,
right.
And, you know, Flying Nun did a lot of that, you know, importing
right.
records into New Zealand, American records and English records too.
Right.
But yeah, there
so
were
anyway,
companies. Yeah.
It was 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
This Pixies,
came out.
Pixies album came out. And I just remember at the time thinking that it just didn't sound like much of anything else that was out at that
That's
time.
Right.
And, you know, being pretty well steeped in the whole college rock thing of the 80s, you know, there were obviously a lot of great bands, and we've
yeah.
talked about a lot of those bands, and but none of them quite, I don't know how to say it, none of them quite had this sound. This sound, you know how we were talking yesterday about Peru Ubu and how they were like, their album came out in the late 70s,
yeah.
but they were already positioning it as if it's like an 80s record. Like they wanted to
right.
it to sort of reflect where they thought the future of music was
mm-hmm.
going. I kind of got this same sense with the Pixies. They came out in 88, but maybe it sounded like something more we were going to hear. You know, it's
good point.
A lot of this might just be me looking back now.
Yeah.
Because it does sound like a 90s record, but
it does.
It did sound really different, I think, at that time.
Yeah, it did. And they went on to, you know, obviously make, you know, very impactful records in the 90s too. I've been thinking about the Pixies a lot. It's one of those, do you ever have a band, Jim, for whatever reason, you just don't get off on the right foot with them?
I have a lot of those.
Do you know
actually.
What I mean?
Yes.
And I can remember seeing them early on, like on the first EP, and they played at the old 930 Club. And I don't remember if I was just like in a bad mood or I was like fighting with my girlfriend or something, but I remember just not getting off on the right foot with them. And that kind of lingers with a person, right? It's kind of hard for me sometimes to go back. And I don't know what it was. And thinking about it as much as I can, I've listened to this record. I listened to the first EP, Come On Pilgrim. And I just think they sound great. You know, yeah. I agree with you. They sound harrowing and comic at times. And, you know, the lyrics are odd. And, you know, there's a strange Stop. Kind of influence that you're not really sure where it's coming from. And it does sound really different and unique. And it certainly... it turned out to be that way, but I don't know what it was. It took me a while to kind of reconcile that relationship.
Of course, that's Where Is My Mind. It has become a classic song over time.
Sure has.
Even if it didn't really make many waves in 1988.
Right. It wasn't a single or anything like that. Right. It just has become this awesome track off the album.
But what's so cool about that, listening to it, is it has a lot of those Pixies sort of hallmarks, the loud, quiet, loud, which is the one thing that everybody knows because Kurt Cobain picked that up and, and you know, ran it far forward. But also the... there's a certain, and I mean this in a good way, there's a certain repetitiveness to their songs, you know, and apparently a lot of this is because you often hear about bands, you know, from the punk era on who, you know, weren't very adept at their instruments, right? Didn't take lessons and, you know, it was the DIY attitude and everything. And apparently that really applied to the Pixies a lot, that maybe over time they picked up a lot more, but at the time of this first album, that apparently they were just sort of making stuff up on their instruments. Yeah. And so it led to this kind of sparse quality to it in a really good way. Like you hear just like individual notes and chords and certain amount of like gaps and silence, but yet it's like sort of layered in a way that gives it kind of an ominous kind of eerie quality. And then those background vocals are what really does it. Right. So it's more about creating a sound experience than creating a song necessarily, but yet it does have a certain catchy quality to it, and everybody really remembers that song. It's become a huge thing.
And I think, you know, some of Black Francis's lyrics on this album in some ways a little bit like Perry Ubu's David Thomas, you know, the singing is a little bit unusual and the lyrics are kind of odd and you're not really quite sure where they are. And there is, you know, throughout a lot of the songs on this record, kind of that tension between Kelly Deal and Black Francis, or as she's known here on the record, Mrs. John Murphy, which I'm not really sure why that is. Do you have any idea?
I don't know why that is either, other than, you know, Black Francis is not his real name either, so they're all sort of taking on. But you mean Kim Deal.
Kim Deal. Oh, did I say Kelly? Yeah, I'm sorry.
Her twin, Kelly Deal.
I'm sorry. Yeah, Kim. But... and also some tension between the producer of the record, apparently, and the band themselves, right?
Right. So Steve Albini was the producer who you have to credit, I think, to a great extent for this sound we're talking about.
Especially with the drums. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. It actually, that was really kind of key because a lot of 80s records really had difficulty with the drums.
Yeah, there was not a defining drum sound, really, and he really changed all that, you know. Ironically, too, in the sense that his band, Big Black, had a drum machine.
Right.
They didn't even have a drummer. You know, that's how he felt about the drums. But, yeah, he was able to produce, and we'll talk about it a little more tomorrow, this incredible drum sound, and obviously on the second Nirvana album, too.
Right.
But also, he kind of, you know, like you were saying, Jim, I think some of the layers were created through the production and the mixing and the way, just in that song, you know, the voice floats in and out. And at times he's like talking about, oh, I'm swimming in the Caribbean. Yet it does kind of feel like you're bobbing, you know, along in the waves. It's very interesting.
And you mentioned the lyrics too. And again,
yeah,
it's another thing that influenced Kurt Cobain, because it's really not, a lot of the songs that really aren't really about much of anything.
Not really.
You know, like this one, Where Is My Mind? I mean, you can read a lot into that. And
sure.
Just in sort of its most basic way, it just sort of resonates with people, because everybody has those moments of sort of like feeling lost or confused,
yeah,
or, you know, troubled in some way. And where is my mind? Right. Like it's where, but he was really writing about an experience like scuba diving,
like something just, like that,
you know?
Yeah.
But the point is, it didn't really matter.
No, you're right. That's very important.
And that's the key with a lot of the Pixies songs. It doesn't really matter exactly what his inspiration for the song was. It's more like what you take out of it. And it's supposed to be cryptic in a certain way. And then again, you know, when I get back to the influence on Cobain's songwriting, I think he took a lot from that, because you listen to a lot of Nirvana songs and they don't directly come out and say, tell you what they're about.
No.
You know, it's a lot of kind of, you know, it's a bit of sort of a puzzle in some ways, but in a bit of sort of just like interpret it however you want. Right.
Yeah, and I always thought that was something cool about the Pixies' music, is that these certain lines would float up, you know, as you're listening to it. And you're like, oh, that's interesting, you know, in similar way to what Michael Stipe would do with R.E.M. Mm-hmm. Occasionally a line would kind of float to the top and you'd grab it.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, I will say Gigantic on this album might be about something pretty specific.
Yeah.
Could be. Yeah, definitely. And there's also, you know, I mean, when you look at the titles, Break My Body, Bone Machine, Broken Face, Oh My Golly, Vamos, you know, there's a lot of sense of like collision and you know, and you hear that in the guitar playing, certainly of Joey Santiago's guitar playing, that kind of goes up and down the neck. But like you said, it's very simple. I mean, you when you listen to this, you definitely feel like if you play guitar at all, you'd be like, oh, that doesn't seem that hard, you know, I can make a riff like that. Yeah.
But yeah, in some ways, he was kind of aping sort of like the surf guitar players of the 60s and things like that. Maybe not as fast or as crazy as some of those guys did, but that definitely that sensibility, like I said, the up and down the neck, creating melody with the lines.
Yeah, exactly right, which was different. And, you know, the rhythm guitar was much more of a strummed at times, you know, kind of acoustic. Like you could see that this weird Black Francis guy, maybe he just wrote these songs in his room or whatever, you know, he was just kind of down there and strumming, or as Bud Verge once said, dorm room in University of Massachusetts Amherst, right? Didn't they get started up there?
Yeah, apparently. Mm-hmm. Bud was instrumental in this,
right? Through the walls.
Yeah.
Turn that noise down, you kids.
That's right.
Trying to study.
Is there a song here that you think is particularly interesting?
Why don't we play a little bit of the first song on the record, Bone Machine?
Yeah.
I always felt like that really grabbed you, you know, when you drop the needle on this one. I think when that song got to that little break and, you know, you hear Your Bones Got a Little Machine, it probably hooked a lot of people for life on the Pixies. So, like, absolutely, I love this record, yeah. And then, you know, a lot of the screaming, talking off microphone, it kind of seemed like he was just babbling about something or other. Like, you know, maybe he was picking up a takeout order while they were recording the song. You know, there was all that kind of interesting stuff left in there.
There was a lot you could sort of, you
fussy
know, dig into here, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. A lot of layers, like
And
you
I
said.
Think Albini was really key to this because it has those touches of noise rock to it. But it's like accessible noise rock. You
That's
know
right.
what I mean? It's like, it's really, it's the kind of thing like you just want to put it on the stereo and just like crank it up, you know, because it's just going to sort of blow you away. It's just really a great in that sense. So,
and I think that Steve, at least some of the stuff I've read, at a certain point when he started to become a more successful producer and kind of set up his own thing and, you know, was recording a lot of bands and, you know, he went so far as to say, I'm not a producer, I'm a recorder. I just like to say I recorded it, right? You know, which is sort of typical Steve Albini, confrontational. You know, a lot of people think he's kind of a jerk, but he's really kind of softened his stance. He was harsh on the Pixies, I think, you know, after the record came out, as saying they didn't know anything. They didn't know what they're doing, you know, blah, 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 or whatever. But and you know, wasn't shy about the fact that he didn't really get along with them that well. But he's really kind of softened his stance on them. If you read some of the things as time and as he's mellowed a little bit and kind of, I think, seen the influence of this album.
Let me play one more just really little clip here before we get into play out territory.
Okay.
But I find this interesting, kind of speaking of influence. There's a song on Surfer Rosa called Cactus. Mm-hmm. And some people say this is a very Nirvana sounding kind of song, but also it was later covered by the great David Bowie.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
I don't think I knew that.
An album that came out in 2002.
Wow.
You did?
Well, David Bowie covers one of your songs. How can that make you feel? That's incredible.
So here you go.
That was really interesting, Jim, because I think when I went back and listened to this after not having listened to it for a while, I got a real sense of the room of, like, you know, it's like when he's talking about the cement floor at the beginning, it sounds like it was recorded in a room like that.
Right.
You know, it was just like a garage or a cement basement or something, because it all echoes around and, you know, it voices come at you from like different places. It's very, very, very cool.
And you know, you mentioned the drum sound. I mean, it's very evident in that song as well.
Really punches you in the
gut. And I mentioned kind of the, you know, has that, again, kind of repetitive quality, just kind of stays on that one riff.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing is really funny with that song in particular is some people don't notice this right away or maybe even notice it at all, but there's a part right there in that break where you hear this kind of like chant kind of thing going on. Almost like little kind of grunts things.
Yeah.
But they're actually spelling out Pixies.
Oh, are they really?
It's almost like a cheerleader kind of chant. It's P.
I never knew that.
Yes.
I actually never knew
that. It's not really super clear, but when you listen to it next time, you'll hear that they're spelling it out.
I'm
going
to have to listen to that. That's I never knew it.
Apparently, when Bowie covered it, he changed it to D-A-V-I-D.
Oh, really?
I guess, yes.
That's amazing. I learn on Rockin' the Suburbs, folks.
So,
this is awesome.
All right, so there you go. That's Surfer Rosa.
Yeah, and certainly I think we'd be remiss because last week we talked about 4AD and we talked about their design aesthetic, and this is another example of Von Oliver and his company later, you know, formed as 23 Envelope, but it's a very distinctive album cover with a exotic or a flamenco dancer with no shirt. So you got that going on. There's an element of sexuality, obviously, about this album, and I think the cover portrays that pretty well, right?
Oh, well, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's also, it's one of those things that when you do that, though, you know, you almost know you're limiting
yes.
your audience,
yes.
right?
Mm-hmm.
People are just not going to buy it.
Put this in your face cover right here on the album rack. Yeah.
Because of that. Yep. So you're really kind of making a statement that this is a different kind of record.
That's right. Yeah. And there, you know, there's Spanish lyrics on the front, you know, it's pretty striking.
But then a few years later, a couple years later, whatever it was, and they came out with Doolittle. I think it was 1990.
Mm-hmm. Is that the one with the monkey on the front?
Yeah, that just took off. I mean,
it did. Yeah.
That has Debaser and mm-hmm. Here Comes Your Man, Monkey Gone to Heaven,
that's right.
And that's where they really then became sort of, it was 89. So it was only the next year. I think it was that year.
Yeah, another level.
But yeah, that's when they sort of became the Pixies.
Right? You're right.
Exactly.
Yeah. But you know, and again, listening back to it, I don't think that the voices, you know, were really treated in a traditional male-female kind of way. You know, her voice floats in, and sometimes she'll just sing one little bit, Kim, and then other times she'll sing a whole thing, or they'll just do a harmony. It's very odd.
Well,
and I think it was influential to
it was
in good and bad ways.
But it's funny because it did lead to a lot of tension
in
the band, and this is perfect for our playout song.
Really
so the one song you mentioned earlier mm-hmm. that Kim Deal sang lead on was Gigantic on Surfer Rosa.
Right.
And that was the one that was released as a single.
That's it.
And really became a really popular song for them.
It did.
And it's funny when I think back to my college days and listen to this record, that was the song that, like, you know how you just kind of have a song in your head and you just kind of sing it when you walk around, right? It seemed like my roommate Tom in particular, like you just catch him over there going Gigantic. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, it just has this song going in his head. It's just, it's that kind of a thing. Very, very catchy.
Yeah. Well, and Mr. Thompson had a way with melody and hook and all that stuff, certainly.
Yes. So we'll play out with that. But getting back to that, it did lead to some tension in the band. Black Francis wasn't too happy with the fact that, you know, maybe Kim Deal was stealing some of the spotlight
when
he was the one
attention.
Writing
yeah.
most of the material
right.
and really considered himself the front man of the band. Led to some tension in the later albums. Kim Deal's vocal contributions became less and less to the point then that she started the Breeders.
Yeah.
And
they did okay.
Did her own thing.
Yeah.
And was pretty successful there.
Yeah.
And she's back doing new Breeders
music
and out on tour. So that's
cool.
So good for her. And the Pixies, who got back together, did so without her.
They did.
And are out, you know, touring now and doing
kind of
all
their own thing.
Yeah. Okay. Let's get out of here real quickly. Tomorrow we're going to do one more album anniversary. It is
PJ Harvey.
That's right.
And
PJ Harvey.
Of me, and it's got quite a few connections to what we just talked about.
It does.
So it's a good seg.
That's a good one. All right. This is Rockin' the Suburbs. Listen to the show
every day.
Find us on all the big podcast platforms. Please rate and review on Apple Podcasts. We need more of those ratings and reviews.
Please.
And we'd love to hear what you think of the Pixies. I'm sure people out there have some opinions on this band.
Oh, yeah.
So you can call 612-440-1984 and leave a message, or you can email us rock@suburbspod.com or find us on the social medias @suburbspod. And with that, I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
This is Gigantic. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
That was the other thing. I always loved that story about getting Kim Deal, that they put an ad that said you should be into Husker Du and Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Oh, yeah, I forgot.
She was the only
that.
One who answered. That's how she got in the band.